From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the May 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Music at Bletchley Park. Against the backdrop of war and secrecy, the Codebreakers of Bletchley Park were often able to enjoy comfort in music, from choirs to orchestras, gramophone evenings to opera. Music appears again and again as a recurring motif in the social lives of those working at the Government Code and Cipher School. This episode delves into several different aspects of a topic that we're often asked about, but frequently gets overshadowed by the showier activities of the BP Drama Group. Head of Content, Erica Munro, and Head of Audiences and Programmes, Vicky Pipe, will discuss some very special musical material from Bletchley Park Trust's archive. Hear from researcher and musician Crispin Lewis about his famous BP relative, composer Herbert Murrell. We're also joined by research officer Dr. Thomas Cheatham to explore links between music and code breaking. Many thanks to Crispin Lewis for allowing us to reproduce his performance of Herbert Murrell's 1942 piece, In Youth Is Pleasure.
Erica, hello.
Hello.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be recording this episode with you this month. It's something we've talked about for a little while. Music and the recreational side of what was happening here at Bletchley Park comes up again and again, and it seeps into both our roles in lots of different ways. So maybe we can start by talking about how it arises in our roles and why is music so important to Bletchley Park?
We do get quite a lot of inquiries coming in about Bletchley Park and music, whether that is people wanting to explore the historical connections between Bletchley Park, the work and music as a discipline, or whether that's people who are being inspired by the Bletchley Park story and producing musical works of their own. I mean, I've been contacted by people writing orchestral pieces, violin concertos and opera.
In my role, looking at public programming, how we engage different audiences with our story, it does come up again and again to people who have written productions that they're touring and would love to come and perform them here. Mm. All kinds of different formats as well, sort of straight plays or musicals. It certainly comes up again and again. We've put on lots of different musical and theatrical productions over the years. So we host outdoor theatre here. The most recent example was our Christmas programme, where we really leaned into this side of our story. We had some wonderful actors on site who were in character as people who worked here during the war. And part of their backstory was that they were all part of the drama club and they were rehearsing for their theatre production, and visitors could step into their public rehearsal to see what was going on. Last year it was A Christmas Carol, so really playing on that kind of fun recreational side of the story. But it really leads into what we know, as much as we know, about what people who worked here at Bletchley Park were doing in the war on that recreational side of things. So Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is? What's in the archives? What do we know?
There's something so compelling about the musical activities that took place here during the war. I think the drama group is more widely known, more widely referenced, and we've certainly covered in previous podcast episodes and things that we've done on site, the activities of the drama group, which forms part of the larger recreational club at Bletchley Park during the war. But the musical society was an independent body of its own within that recreational club umbrella. So we'll call the recreational club the Rec Club, but within that, keep in mind that the musical society had its own activities, its own members, separate from the drama group. Sometimes they combined activities and supported each other, but quite often the musical society was doing its own thing. And the variety that we've been able to find within the archives of what they were doing is so interesting. I've been having a good old dig through our records, having a look at some of the materials that have been preserved in Bletchley Park Trust's archives, and I've been looking at various sources, having conversations with a few people as well, to really get behind the musical activities that were taking place. One thing that I wanted to bring along for our conversation today is a pamphlet which was produced, printed professionally for the Bletchley Park Recreational Club, listing the activities that were part of its remit. We'll put a picture of this pamphlet on the Bletchley Park website, on the page that's dedicated to this podcast. So if you are listening, have a look in the blurb and there'll be a link there so that you can have a look too.
It is a brilliant document.
It's so lovely, isn't it? It's the Bletchley Park Recreational Club, located in the club room. And on the front, it says, on the succeeding pages, I love this, an introduction to the pamphlet. You will find a list of the various activities of the Bletchley Park Recreational Club. And as we're focusing particularly on music today, I wanted us to really zone in on musical society. So this pamphlet says that the secretary, Miss Sawyer, is located in Block F. So that tells us that this pamphlet is from later on in the war. And it lists some of the things that were taking place. So gramophone concerts every Wednesday evening at 6:15 in the writing room, which we think was in the mansion. Lunchtime concerts as advertised. The Choral Society every Monday in the sports room at 6 o'clock as advertised. And then periodical concerts arranged from time to time. So there's a lot of performances going on, rehearsals going on.
It is brilliant. I love gramophone concerts. So it sounds quite formal, but do you think it was just people bringing their records, sharing their records, playing it? Or was it more of a formal thing maybe? I don't know if we know this or we can find out. But there seems to be like a whole variety of different stuff happening from the sort of formal to informal. I know we're not digging into the other elements, but music must have featured in some of these other activities that are listed, like dancing. Mm-hmm. So was the music that accompanied the dancing, was it live or was it records that people were playing, reels? I don't know about fencing, maybe not to music, but...
On guard,
exactly. It's feeding into some of these other elements as well. So there must have been so much music happening in all kinds of different ways.
Certainly. Gramophone concerts are really interesting. And I think something that to listeners today, or to many listeners today, will be a bit of an unusual and familiar concept, keeping in mind that probably people were bringing in their own records and sharing them and listening to them as a social activity. We do know that these are mostly classical, but there were the odd sort of swing music evenings as well, based on some of the testimony that's been recorded and in the official record of the kinds of music that was played at these get-togethers. I mean, music would have been available on the radio, but far less easy to access, I would say, recorded music than it is today. We just take podcasts like this one and recorded music and downloads, even things like CDs, that are really for granted. But access to the equipment to play it, Bletchley Park did purchase its own radiogram, invested in such a piece of equipment so that it could play these gramophone records and then people could listen, discuss as a social group. And it was certainly very popular.
I really want us to recreate the gramophone society. I'm very much up for this. It's interesting what you said about you feel it was probably much more classical music. And that's in contrast to what I would have thought, because I think broadly speaking, and particularly some of the events that we put on, if we're putting on musical performances or acts, it's much more in that sort of popular swing, big band kind of genre. Mm-hmm. That's what I had in my head. But you're saying there's evidence that it was much more on the sort of classical side, which is interesting.
Well, looking at some of the other activities that aren't covered in this pamphlet, there was certainly a high quality orchestra at Bletchley Park as part of the musical society. There was a jazz quintet. There was at least one choir, if not multiple choirs, a madrigal group. There was a choral society, as it says here, meeting every Monday. So it seems that the music that was being performed and produced, sort of organised by Bletchley Park, is a little bit more traditional, a bit more formal. But I'm guessing that the more fun, popular type of music was probably done more informally. We know that from some memoirs that people did get together in houses, in billets, and sort of jam together or have a bit of a sing-along. Gordon Welshman, the head of Hut 6, has talked about it. Peter Calvacaresi from Hut 3 also was known for getting people together for a bit of a musical evening. And we know that in some of the other accommodation provided for the staff that were working at Bletchley Park, musical activities were also organised. So adjacent to Bletchley Park itself were two large military camps where people in the army and in the RAF and the Women's Arms were based. Shenley Road Military Camp for the army and RAF Church Green both had bands and choral activities going on there that put on performances. We also know that the Wrens, who were billeted or based at Woburn Abbey, they also had a choral group that met in the basement to practice. We actually have a photograph of a group of Wrens singing away at a Christmas, or they're either performing or practicing for their Christmas concert. So there's these little bits of information that we're able to piece together about a lot of musical activity, whether very formalised or just sort of ad hoc day to day.
Do you think that the more formal classical music that was being performed, do you think that was because of the type of people who were recruited here? So people who might have come from University of Oxford or Cambridge. What do we think the thinking behind why the sort of formal activities were much more of that classical style?
It's a tricky one because the people who were organising those activities were definitely embedded in those worlds. There were some very well-known musicians that we'll be talking about, and those involved at quite a high level in the production and the broadcasting and the organisation of classical music in this country. And it may be that they were steering the activities that were going on for the wider staff. It might be that it was seen as a bit more sort of self-improvement as well, okay, for the more formal music. It might just be that that was the more popular style amongst those who were able to attend those kinds of performances. We know that those in the services are quite a lot younger. And so when there's young women in the services, for example, possibly they may have had an interest in classical music. But if they were interested more in the big band style of things, they had less personal freedom to pop out and go to a concert, whether it was one organised at Bletchley Park or whether it's one organised elsewhere near where they were staying or in Bedford or even in London.
So can we talk about some of these performances, these concerts? You've brought with you some brilliant, like, I want to call them playbills, but they're not because it's a musical concert, but it's similar in kind of style where you've got a little advert, a little flyer for these taking place. And we've got some big names here.
Really
big names.
Yes, the concerts were organised by staff, either in-house performances with some of the musical talent from amongst the staff cadre or bringing in big names. And they were for fundraising efforts, raising money for charity, Worship Week or the Red Cross or Great Ormond Street. But they were also sort of for staff morale. And they were sometimes organised by external bodies such as CEMA, which was the Council for the Encouragement of Music and the Arts.
The Council for the Encouragement
of Music and the Arts.
Oh, brilliant.
Which was established in 1940, but actually changed its name, now called the Arts Council. Those of us that work in culture are very, very familiar with the Arts Council. But also, as I say, organised internally by some of those who are very well connected. The playbills, I suppose, the flyers that we've got, again, professionally printed about the sorts of performances and recitals that took place. The two that I have brought along today as well are in the Assembly Hall, which was a purpose-built venue currently outside the perimeter of Bletchley Park, which was in wartime called the Assembly Hall and is now called Wilton Hall and is still used as a public music venue. We recommend you have a little look at what's on. But it was built for the purposes of performances and gatherings for the staff at Bletchley Park during the war from 1943 onwards. And there's a capacity of about 400 people. So they could put on big concerts that could also, because it was on the perimeter, be attended by local people. And so some of the names of those who were brought in to perform, the soprano Isabel Bailey is one of them. The Griller String Quartet came a few times. The Jacques or Jake String Quartet as well, the string orchestra. Dame Myra Hess is
one huge name, like a huge name.
Absolutely. Pianist Dame Myra Hess, who I think is, in terms of wartime performances, better known for doing performances at the National Portrait Gallery in London, but brought here to Bletchley Park. And we have this programme of a performance that she gave in 1943. And just looking at the kind of pieces that were being performed as well, there's Bach, Beethoven, Chopin. Actually, somebody has scribbled on this as well, a few notes about other pieces that perhaps, I like to think that might have been an encore that was played
yes,
at the end as well.
More. We want one more
Dame Myra Hess. But it must have been a real treat for people who recognised the names of these big, well-known musicians that were, I suppose, touring the country and that this was actually deemed to be an appropriate stop for them to go to.
Yeah. What must have local people thought? You mentioned that some of these concerts were open to members of the public as well because they took place outside of the perimeter of Bletchley Park itself. I'm often fascinated and visitors often say, well, you know, there are 9,000 people here. How can nobody notice what was going on? But then to also have this activity that people living in the local area could come to with such high profile people. I mean, what do you think the impact on that was for people living in Bletchley? Did they just think, oh, they're just on tour and we're lucky to get them?
Imagine. Well, we also know that I think the most popular musician playing near Bletchley Park that's been spoken about is Glenn Miller playing at bases in Bedford. And so I think there were concerts happening around the country so people could attend. We know that there were reviews of some of the concerts produced internally, published in the Bletchley Gazette, the local paper. And certainly that must have been seen as a real benefit to have this kind of organized provision of culture and the arts. But also, I suppose, just like the people that worked at Bletchley Park, a lot of people would not have been bothered by Dame Myra Hess coming to the local area if you're not really into that kind of thing. So I think it was certainly seen as a benefit to the area, but there were people, yeah, who would, it would not have registered on their day-to-day. We know that the number of concerts that were produced was significant. There is no entire list of every concert that was put on here, just like there's no list of every staff member, or there's no specific list of every single department that was produced at the time. The records are patchy and incomplete. But researcher Harold Liberty has actually been to Bletchley Park Archive, had a look at the materials we have here, and also gone to the National Archives and other archival sources. And he's found 34 different concerts that were produced either by or with the Bletchley Park Musical Society throughout the war. So they were putting these things on regularly for the benefit of the staff. It does say on the pamphlet that we're looking at earlier about the subscriptions as well. So if you were in the Recreational Society, you were paying a shilling a month, or the bargainous price of 10 shillings for the whole year, which then gave you access to all of these activities. We're not sure if the individual concerts were then charged on top of that, but certainly it seems to have been a very reasonable deal for all that culture.
Is there a paper trail? And we often find this with theatre and the arts in history, for example, Henslowe's Diary, who was the owner of the Globe when Shakespeare was performing. We know what plays were being performed because we have the accounts of the person who owned it. So you've got what seems kind of sort of a boring kind of accountant's list of, oh, Romeo and Juliet brought in this amount of money. Do we have sort of similar evidence? If people are paying subscriptions, is there a record of that anywhere?
The Recreational Club did do an annual report, which did report on the income that was generated through it. And those survive in the National Archives. So the end of year reports, which also lists some of the activities that were happening in all these different areas of the Recreational Society, but also the Musical Society. It names individuals that have organised concerts. It talks about significant events that have happened throughout the year. It is pretty interesting, actually, because the evidence that we get from oral history is actually quite thin. And so having these nuggets of facts that have been recorded and reported as a sort of formal angle of it is incredibly helpful. I would have thought, looking at the oral history, the sort of testimony archive that's out there, that music would be something people would talk about in huge detail. But we've really struggled to find veterans talking a lot about their musical experiences at Bletchley Park. They tend to just sort of mention that they went to these concerts or that this person came and performed, but actually there's not a lot of detail around that. It has been really helpful collating what's there in the National Archives with some of these pieces of ephemera that have survived. And there's a reasonable amount of the ephemera survived in Bletchley Park Trust's archive, with the nuggets from oral history, with limited, I should say, reviews in the Bletchley Gazette about the local performances. The surviving material is interesting and rare. One particular rarity that we're really excited about having in the archival record is a recording, an audio recording of The Marriage of Figaro. We know that in 1945, in May, the BBC recorded the Musical Society performing both the Kyrie from Vaughan Williams' Mass and part of The Marriage of Figaro for Workers' Playtime and broadcast it. And we believe that we have a section of the audio from The Marriage of Figaro. I should caveat it and say that the records are incomplete as to how we have acquired this, but it is noted that it was sent to us with the understanding that it was a copy of the BBC record that recorded this particular performance. So can't be 100% sure, let's say, but it is our trusting belief that this is the only piece of audio recording that we have of those who took part in the Musical Society at Bletchley Park in the war.
Now your days of philandering are over, and you're swaying from power to power. Now the war as a place is young over, comes an end to those romps with the hay. Now the war as a place is young over, play Adonis with each pretty maid. Now put off all your dainty belongings, cap the plume and your gewgaws and graces. Cut your hair, there's no need for such laces. Soon your lilies and roses will fade. Soon your lilies and roses. all different things. Yes, put up your gay belongings, all your jewels and your grace, and your need for pretty faces.
How on earth did they get on the BBC? Like, what links have we got going on here? We talked before about some of those public concerts with those big performers, big popular names. Mm-hmm. But to have the internal orchestra of an organisation, a secret organisation, being recorded by the BBC, like, how do we think that might have come about?
There was some very high-level contacts between those at Bletchley Park and those outside in the world of the arts and culture. So some of those quite well-connected individuals, including Herbert Murrell, who we'll find out more about later in this episode, who worked at the BBC and went on to greater things, but also professional musicians, composers, musical scholars, professors of music, were co-breakers at Bletchley Park or had contacts and connections with those who were working in intelligence here. So there's certainly this very high level, very high quality musical output was being produced here. And maybe that's how some of these big names were able to actually come here and perform. Some names that I think our listeners will be very familiar with as well, of those who were perhaps more amateur but well-known musically. The best known is Bryn Newton-John. Olivia Newton-John's father played the part of the Count in one of the iterations of The Marriage of Figaro. And I like to think that perhaps he is somebody that we've just heard in that clip. That would be incredible. But other names that we know were very, very involved with the music that took place here, Douglas Jones, Rosamund Twin, they're in performance after performance. And there are people who, in their oral history testimonies, even just mention, I was very musical during the war and I was known as a musician in my family. Actually, singer James Blunt, his grandmother was here and she was known as the musical member of her family as well.
Really?
Even though we have very little evidence of her participating, she was a Colossus operator.
How wonderful.
So maybe Bletchley Park has helped produce more musicians even after the war than
James
during.
Blunt, if you're listening. We often describe Bletchley Park is like a university campus because there was young people here. But this added layer of music and the other recreational activities that were taking place, it kind of heightens the sense of that kind of vibe that was going on.
Yeah.
Is that just a byproduct of having such a vast range of different people in one space, lots of creative people involved, naturally going to happen? Or was there a real directive from the people in charge to encourage this kind of stuff?
I think the latter. We know that music is an important means of providing welfare, morale, a sort of community spirit. And I think that there must have been an understanding by those helping to fund the recreational club and helping to organise these things from the top down, that that was a really valuable way of providing support to the workforce.
But that's like a lot of work-related activities now. It could be supported by them. There is not necessarily an endless pot of money.
Exactly.
But the fact that there was that underlying support from those in charge, recognising the benefit that supporting it would have.
And not just financial support, but providing space for it to happen. There was a piano in Hut 12 for people to practice. The locations that we spoke about on the leaflet of the Rec Club, there was this broader support organisationally, socially, pastorally as well. And as I've said, organising choirs at the accommodation, it makes sense that that is something that those in charge, a means by which they were using to help maintain morale. It's also quite low cost to sing or produce a bit of group music. And yes, there's instruments, there's performances and all of that, but whittling it down to the very basics, music is a free activity. It's a group activity as well, very often. Imagine these people are all away from home. They don't necessarily know each other other than through work. And this provides a non-work means for people to communicate. It's also a bit of a social leveller, I suppose. You don't need to have a particular social background in order to communicate through music. Music was an out loud activity. You know, there weren't headphones to pop on and we can all sit in the corner like we do nowadays. You know, people on the tube with their headphones on and just focusing right in. It was something that people could gather together to do and that you couldn't help but hear. So I think that there's these reasons behind why music itself was a real driver in bringing people together and a sort of a positive driver. In the Recreational Club's constitution, which was in 1940, there's a brilliant quote about what it's all for. The Rec Club as a whole, not just the musical society, but I think it's really pertinent. It reads, "The Recreational Club, its aim is to provide for all members of BP facilities for recreation and amusement, which otherwise do not exist in Bletchley, and in particular, to cater for the junior members of the joint organisation whose billets are often poor and whose resources are limited." So it is that leveller, it's that group gathering social positivity that seems to be embedded right at the heart of why people were doing this in the first place.
I don't think it's sort of the flip side of it, but maybe it complements it in a way. We sometimes talk, and we're going to dive into it a little bit more in this episode, that having a musical mind or using your mind in a musical way can help your code-breaking activities as well. Music is providing all of these benefits, a relief, a release, a way to socialise, to improve your well-being, but it's also helping your mind for the work that you have to do as well.
Yeah, and we've said not everybody at Bletchley Park was a, you know, cryptanalyst, but certainly, you're right, we'll have a little dig into the connections between code-breaking and music. But I think even those who were, I don't know, indexing or translating or operating machinery, I think there are elements of all of those roles that connect with music and what music can bring.
I wonder if modern day intelligence officers are also musically minded.
Funny you should say that. I had a little look because I thought the modern day successor or the organisation that was at Bletchley Park during the war is now called GCHQ, which is now in Cheltenham. And I wondered if there was a similar sort of thing. Quite hard to find out.
I'm sure.
There is evidence from 2014 of GCHQ's in-house brass band, which is absolutely brilliantly called Top Secret Brass.
No, it's not.
Indeed it is. or was, because I'm not entirely sure if it is still going. It'd be absolutely wonderful if it is. If anybody is at GCHQ or knows whether Top Secret Brass is still going, then do let us know. But clear that the sort of organisationally supported musical activities within Signals Intelligence still going on today. There are numerous names that we could talk about, individuals who were well known for different skills or talents in music who served at Bletchley Park. Composers like Daniel Jenkin-Jones, Robert Marchant, the violin impresario André Mongeau, who didn't actually work at Bletchley Park but was brought in to help train some of the people playing in the string quartet. There are so many people that we would talk about if we had the time. But in particular, in today's episode, there's one standout figure that we wanted to focus on, and that is Herbert Murrell. Vicky met with a special guest of the podcast to find out more about this musician, composer, and conductor.
Music you just heard was from a Bletchley Park codebreaker, Herbert Murrell, and we are delighted to have on the podcast this month Crispin Lewis, who is a musician but also has a family connection to Herbert Murrell. Welcome, Crispin.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tell us a little bit, what is your connection to Herbert Murrell?
It's a very small connection in a way, but it's one that got me very interested in researching him, digging up his music, digging up his history, and then finding out about this amazing Bletchley Park angle, and then having my eyes open to, wow, how much music was going on at Bletchley and how many different people were contributing and what a high standard that music was. So Herbert Murrell, he married my great aunt in the 1930s. He'd come from a very working class family. His father was working in a cork factory and gradually sort of worked his way up. But Herbert was determined to be a musician. And so determined, against his parents' wishes, who obviously wanted him to get a proper job, and there was a sort of Great Depression time around when he was growing up, so you could understand that, he ran away from home for 4 months and didn't come back until they agreed to let him become a musician, got a scholarship to all four of the top music colleges, went to the Royal Academy, came out, got a place at an Oxford University college, Worcester College, then came out and became the youngest ever Professor of Composition at the Royal Academy of Music. So you can see he was very determined, had a very fast course through music, then got recruited by the BBC. And this is how he came to get involved with Bletchley Park, because the BBC was evacuated, I think, four times in the early war years. 1939 got sent, well, eventually to Bristol, and then it turned out to be the very worst place for them to be because there was a blitz in Bristol, bombing everywhere, everything exploded, so the BBC relocated to Bedford.
Okay, just up the road.
Yeah, exactly. He was a programme organiser at the BBC by then, dealing with a lot of complicated administration. He was a musician and he was a linguist as well. He was fluent in French, knew several other languages, and had just the sort of brain that perhaps they were looking for. Finally, one thing might have tipped the balance. Just as he'd got recruited into the army and started doing some army training, he was put on a motorbike, and they do a lot of motorcycle training, and had a horrible accident, came off, bruised and battered all over, and slipped a disc in his back and could barely move. So you think, well, someone with that sort of skill and a mind, what can we do with him? We don't know exactly how he was recruited, but you can sort of fill in the gaps and maybe have a guess.
His skill in music must have shown from quite an early age, or his passion. Do you know anything about that?
He grew up in a tiny street in southeast London, in Brockley. I grew up there. This is the weird thing about this research. I turn out to have been in all the same places that he's been in right up to the end of his life. But in that road was a piano teacher. Across the road was a young girl that he made friends with of the same age, and they developed this sort of rivalry between them. They were both learning the piano. They both went in for a competition when they were 15 years old. One of them came first and one of them came second. He had this determination, but he told his friend, who was called Marjorie, that he was so unhappy because they were constantly trying to persuade him to do a proper job. For some reason, they wanted him to join the Foreign Legion. I mean, I can't imagine why that was a good choice, but they But he said, no, I'm going to be a musician. He became a very good sight reader, funnily enough. It turns out he didn't work particularly hard at his scales and technical work early on. He turned up at a crucial music exam early on and he'd learnt the wrong pieces. He was very nervous and shy. They put the right pieces in front of him. And instead of confessing, he just sight read them on the spot and he still passed it.
Wow. Do you know much about his musical influences? What kind of compositions was he creating? What was he interested in? And what are some of his most significant works?
Early on, there were these very clear influences from about three or four directions. One of them was this amazing history in the early 20th century of the Ballet Russe. There was this idea with the Ballet Russe and things like the famous Rite of Spring that you could meld all of the arts together. You could have the visual art, you could have dance, and you could have music, and you could create a kind of total art. Now, why would someone, a teenager in London, know about all this? Well, the Ballet Russe was a touring company. They appeared, obviously, a lot in Paris, where they were based, but they would appear at what is now the London Coliseum. And you could get tickets incredibly cheap. I mean, for someone like him, who was not at all wealthy, he could travel up to London on the train from Brockley and go and hear them when they did a season there. And he was just staggered by what was going on there. And he heard Stravinsky's music. So Stravinsky's music was a very major influence, and that got him into the idea of artists like Picasso, the composer Francis Poulenc, who, I'll tell you later, actually was one of the visitors to Bletchley Park and became a very good friend later of Herbert Marolles and his family. But he was struck by that music, various other composers, a composer called Peter Warlock, who was an incredible influence on him. Peter Warlock had a very short life, influenced a number of composers during the First World War. Peter Warlock was a conscientious objector. And what he did was went to Ireland, got involved in all sorts of occultism. His original name was Philip Heseltine, but he changed his name to Warlock because he became a warlock, got into occultism, and completely changed his style of music to something that was entirely, I think, original and striking and influenced all sorts of composers. So Herbert Marolles got very interested in that. That affected his style. Francis Poulenc, who was the French composer, affected his music. And Stravinsky, those were the three main influences. While I'm on Poulenc, I might as well say Poulenc had two sides to the character of his music. Some of his music was actually very religious. He later became very seriously religious, but he always kept this rather cheeky side that came from the cafe music of Paris and from jazz and light music. And You find that in Herbert Murrell's music. He's always making a sort of slightly cheeky joke in his music, just as Poulenc did. And there's always a twinkle in the eye of his music. Murrell even wrote his own little sort of French cafe style songs in that style. And often his music has that side. So there's a lot of musical influences well before he came to Bletchley. But as you'll hear, when you listen to different bits of his music, they're all in the music that he later wrote and in the music he brought to Bletchley.
You mentioned the religious style of music, which was influential.
Yeah.
I've got a seed of a memory.
Yeah.
He wrote some incredibly significant choral and church pieces. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, this is a kind of unusual thing about Murrell, because I suspect he wasn't terribly religious. And even when he died, he had a very short life, died at the age of 43. But he wrote, "No religious music is to attend my funeral rites," at the end. And yet he worked in churches all his life, just like Poulenc did. And I think the piece that people will most know him for, and classical musicians most know him for, and anyone who's been a choir boy or a choir girl will know him for, is his Magnificat and Nunc Dimittis in E, which is sung, I would say, almost every week in a collegiate foundation or a cathedral or a major church somewhere in the sphere of Anglican music, which is not just in Britain, but all around the world. This is the music that I think even if people don't realise they know it, they suddenly hear it and think, ah, I recognise that. And that became his most famous work. And he wrote that in 1944 while he was a codebreaker at Bletchley Park. Where he found the time, I don't know, when I find out what he was doing there. But he wrote his most well-known work while he was here doing everything else. If you want something done, ask a busy person, perhaps you could say.
He's so prolific in his music writing and his composition. How do you feel like that impacted the musical life of Bletchley Park? Was he incredibly heavily involved, do you know?
Well, I think so. He was very senior at the BBC. So, as you know, at Bletchley, it was very important that certain things weren't written down, and very little was written down. And even that which was often destroyed. Your historian here told me, he said, well, he's almost conspicuous by how little was written about him, given that he was here and how high up he was in the BBC. But when you start to delve into the memoirs and things people have written about him, you realise there was a massive amount going on. There was a choir every week, which we know he conducted the rehearsals of. Various people in their accounts of Bletchley mention him conducting it. I think, crucially, visiting musicians. There are all sorts of accounts of very well-known musicians visiting Bletchley Park, giving performances and descriptions of them clambering out of vans at various points and not necessarily knowing before or after exactly who they were performing for. I think Myra Hess is probably the most famous pianist. Mm. She gave hundreds and hundreds of performances all over Britain during the war. But there were very famous people like Benjamin Britten and Peter Peers coming here. Someone I mentioned earlier was Poulenc, the most famous French composer of the time, and Pierre Bernac, the most celebrated French singer, perhaps of the 20th century, for whom all sorts of composers, Debussy, Poulenc, Ravel, wrote vast numbers of songs. I know that Herbert Murrell was a friend of Poulenc's, and I can just imagine perhaps, you know, them trying out songs together, and we don't know what they did because it wasn't written down in the meantime, but we know they knew each other. A lot of the most well-known musicians I know knew Murrell very well before the war and after the war. Rubra, the composer, was another one that we have a description from Asa Briggs, the famous BBC historian, of him having visited and performed for the Codebreakers. Now, Herbert Murrell worked with Bally Rombert right at its beginnings in the 1930s, playing as a pianist for them, making arrangements of works and also composing for them. They came here during the war, so these are not just coincidences, I think. For instance, one of the pieces Bally Rombert performed at Bletchley Park was one for which Murrell had made some piano arrangements. So, you know, there are all these coincidences, but what we cannot do is read a piece of paper saying this was why or that was why, this is why. We have to make inferences.
As you said, it hasn't handily been written down and passed down to you. How did you go about piecing all of these nuggets of information together to build this picture of what Herbert's life might have been like?
Well, it started with me finding his music in the BBC archives and getting access to that and to these vast number of scores there, some of which, by the way, have never been published, some of which have been published but have fallen long out of print. And then I found little references and little jottings on the scores. By the way, he was a great doodler and he used to caricature people and draw little pictures of people. And in any boring meeting or anything like that at the BBC, he would draw caricatures of people. So I found caricatures, little notes, scores of theatre productions. So then I started to investigate archives of theatre performances he'd been doing before, musical performances he'd been doing before, trying to track down friends and family members. And this became a real bit of detective work because we expect things to be on the other end of a Google search these days. But so many things that had not been transcribed or people that had, for very good reasons, often just kept off the internet, not ended up being traceable. When I found them, they were universally enormously helpful, talked to me, pointed me to other sources. And I found just by talking to people, I found out a vast amount about what had been going on. So, for instance, going to the Rombert archive, their archivist just talked to me about all these things here at Bletchley Park, at the BBC Written Archive, at the BBC Music Archive, at the Army Archives. If you're an archivist there, you've got a natural interest. And I could just sit there and listen to their stories and find out bit by bit by bit. And it began to fascinate me. You begin to feel like a detective trying to piece things together.
Has it been a real labour of love for you to find out about someone you're personally connected to, but as a musician yourself? I mean, has it influenced you?
Yeah, amazingly so. I mean, I should say it won't come out for another year, but I've started writing the biography of Herbert Murrell and it's led me on a lot of trips to different places. Just last week led me to the Pyrenees. The Murrell connection is he was a friend of Casals. He went there to visit him, stayed with him and ended up writing a cello concerto formed out of the Song of the Birds, which was a song of protest that Casals played at the end of every one of his concerts that he gave when he was protesting against fascism. He would finish it with a speech when he eventually agreed to play again against authoritarianism and fascism. And then he would play something called the Song of the Birds, which was an old Catalan Christmas carol. Murrell went there both before the war and before he came to Bletchley and afterwards, fell in love with this tune and was deeply moved by this story, wrote this cello concerto, which was then performed at the BBC Prom concert.
Do you think Herbert's wartime experiences carried over into his post-war career? You said, sadly, he died very young, but the career that he had after the war, do you think he was influenced heavily by his wartime experiences?
I mean, I'm certain of that. And particularly here at Bletchley, it was the most intense creative environment. When you look at the other people around him, he was working in Japanese codes, but what they wouldn't do, it seems, was just stop and have a rest or a lie down. Despite the stress, they would throw themselves into a creative process and start making all this other, I hesitate to use the word work, but it's something tremendously intellectually demanding in a different way and in an artistic way. And then immediately after Bletchley, in 1945, certain people like Murrell and some others were sent on to Lutonhoof Formation College. There's an archive in the Army Archives that will tell you about what happened here. Suddenly, directly after the war, there were a lot of demilitarized soldiers with all sorts of different skills, and the government had to decide what to do with them. Now, Lutonhoof Formation College was called Formation College Number 5, and I know that it was one of the first ones, perhaps it was the fifth, I don't know. But they were given, I believe it was something like 14, 15 days to turn this stately home, Lutonhoof, which had 364 rooms, and they were absolutely massive rooms. A few years before it was a formation college, they turned this into an army sort of depot. I think they were even trying out at one stage Churchill tanks for a while on the grounds here. But where I came at it was 1945, Herbert Murrell ends up there, and they have 2 weeks to suddenly make it from that into a formation college, which was a kind of university in which 1 month courses were done, and then all of the people on the 1 month course would go, and another lot would come, and then another lot. And they would have something like, I think it was 600, and this is no exaggeration, different teachers, different subjects, anything from plumbing, welding, building, to portrait painting, music.
Yes, of course.
So they had two or three music instructors, about five art instructors, all sorts of trades, shorthand typing, every job you could possibly think of. And this amazed me as someone in the arts. Every month they would mount a theatre production, a brand new one. They would rehearse for a month among the people there, and then they would put one on with songs put together, which, again, nothing was written down directly, but I know Murrell was, there's a photograph even of him teaching the soldiers. How can we get you all to write a song, put one together for this show we're going to put on, this theatre piece? We're going to compose the music and put it together. We're going to make the scenery. And then, believe it or not, the next month they would do a different theatre production, then a different one, and then a different one. So that's what he did for the next, goodness me, over a year after Bletchley. And then he was taken back on full-time at the BBC, and he was giving talks around the country, and he had a young family by now. He had a daughter and a busy wife who was a professional cellist. So he was just doing everything at once, and then rose by 1952 to head of music at the BBC. And then within, God, it was only about a year of doing that, and then sadly died of lung cancer. So it was very, very sudden, a very short life of 43 years into which he crammed an immense amount. But I think somehow Bletchley suited him, because he would have had so many artistic, creative influences coming from all directions. And he was forced to become a great organiser of all sorts of different things. And that may have stood him in good stead for the BBC work he later did. 1950, he was on the verge of becoming head of music at the BBC. What did he have on his plate? The Festival of Britain of 1951.
Yes,
so he had a year to put together that. So he was putting together all of the music, all of the classical music, but he was also in charge of all the broadcasting of the BBC of it. So the Festival of Britain was being broadcast all around the world on the radio. And this was, you know, one of the central points of it. It wasn't just happening in Britain, but it was going all around the world. And it was Britain's statement. We are still here. We are back. We're not reduced to nothing. Look what creativity we have and what we have to say about ourselves.
Crispin, thank you so much. It was so wonderful to chat to you and to find out more about Herbert Murrell. We're going to play another little section from In Youth Is Pleasure. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes, this is one of the songs that it was previously published, had fallen out of print, but which I rediscovered. I can't say I discovered it, but I think it's one of his best songs. It's certainly his most exuberant, and it came at a particular point in his life. This was 1942. He was living in Blunham Rectory, so Blunham's quite nearby to here. He'd been working at the BBC, and he'd been recruited for the army, and then he was going to end up here. He was married, and his daughter had just been born, and I think this song expresses a kind of ecstasy. The words do, but the way the music is, it never stays still. It keeps going to another place, and then another place, and another place. And it has this sense of joy about it. And it's right at the point where he's just about to come to Bletchley.
We're joined by Bletchley Park Research Officer, Dr. Thomas Cheetham, who I think, Tom, you would say probably you're not necessarily a music expert, but you have been here for about 8.5 years now, and I think you've seen a thing or two about code breaking.
I've never written a piece of music or read a piece of music or broken a code in my life, but I'll do my best.
I'm interested in your opinions because I have a very particular question for you. What do you think are the key connections between music and code breaking?
Well, aside from the big one, which is the cultural aspect of people at Bletchley Park being from normally an upper or middle class background that gives them the education they need to, on the one hand, be expert mathematicians and classicists, on the other hand, have some musical training. There's that big overlap. But put that to one side, the connection between music and code breaking is that they're both mathematical and logical. And they're also about pattern recognition. So it makes perfect sense that being a good musician often overlaps with being a good codebreaker. It's very similar to how there's an overlap between cruciverbalists and codebreakers.
Excellent word.
Codebreaking isn't the same as doing crosswords. Just because you're good at crosswords, you might be a terrible codebreaker, and vice versa. But they tend to involve complementary skills. And we've talked about Herbert Muriel, and it seems like this relationship is especially true with the sort of super enciphered codes that he was working on in the Japanese work he was doing. It's because it's about pattern recognition. So the way these codes work is you take your message, you break it down into words and phrases, and then you convert them into numerical groups based on a code book. And that gives you a string of apparently random numbers. And then you super encipher them. You get more strings of random numbers from a super encipherment book. We call these additives, or you can use a table. There's various different ways of doing it, but you add these on using non-carrying addition. So the way that works is, for example, if you imagine adding the numbers 8 and 5, you don't get 13, you get 3, because when you get to 10, you go back to the beginning.
Okay, yeah. Like a clock face where you go from 12 and then you go back to 1 again.
Exactly like that, yeah. If you're breaking these codes, you have to kind of attack it from two directions at once, because you have to try and break the super encipherment and the underlying codebook almost at the same time, mm-hmm. if you're unlucky. And the way to start that attack is, as people will be quite familiar with, the idea of cribs, the idea of known plain text, and especially anticipating where addresses, names of places, days of the week, things like that. If your enemy has to spell something out letter by letter, there's normally a section of the code book that you can do that with these so-called spellers. That makes a good way of getting into a code in the first place. So you would be applying these cribs and trying to subtract one set of putative additives from the message and see if anything recognizable came out.
Right.
Someone who works with Herbert Muriel on Japanese codes is a composer called Daniel Jenkin Jones, who is a Welsh composer. He's a contemporary of Dylan Thomas. He used to hang out with him. He knows Vernon Watkins as well in the Air section. There's a bit of a group there from South Wales who will work at Bletchley Park.
Sort of Welsh intellectual artistic types.
Indeed. We have some of his papers. Some of it's kind of Japanese or Chinese characters. He's trying to get a grasp of the language to help his code breaking, because of course that's useful. But also some of his scribblings are, of course, musical notation. This might not be surprising. But one of these exercises is where Jones has a melody and he's transposing it between different keys and seeing what the result comes out like. If you're used to handling patterns in that way, it's a very similar process mentally to taking a crib and applying it to different points in a message and seeing if anything recognisable comes out when you do the subtraction.
Like a motif, repeated motif in music, I suppose.
Yeah, so you try it in each position. And if any of the sort of groups that decode are something that you recognise as maybe a group from the code book that you've been able to identify previously, you know you might be onto something and that might be a possible solution. I don't know if musicians were necessarily being recruited specifically. I've not seen any evidence that they were being asked at interviews. Are you musical? But you can imagine, especially in this type of code breaking, musicians kind of, they're the kind of cream that rises to the top because their brains quite readily adapt to work on super enciphered codes.
It's interesting, we've been using the word musician as a really broad term. I mean, lots of different features come into being a musician. If you're a pianist, it can be quite different to if you're an oboist. And if you are somebody that listens to music or somebody that writes music and constantly sort of notates music in a very text almost based way, they're all slightly different skills. The reading, the writing, the handling multiple tunes at the same time, whether you're a pianist that's playing two different tunes on two different hands, or whether you're a composer that's creating overlaying of different types of melodies and harmonies. It seems like there are all these different skills and abilities and aspects of being a musician that all contribute to being good at these different types of code breaking.
I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream.
We have heard about the musical activities that were taking place at Bletchley Park during the war. We've heard a little bit about the individuals, some big names that were either performing here or that were working here as codebreakers. And we've explored a little bit the connections between codebreaking and music. Vicky, you're a musician yourself, aren't you?
Very amateur.
Do you think you would have made a good codebreaker with your musical knowledge?
I mean, I have to say yes, of course. I would like to think I would. Music is still part of Bletchley Park now as a heritage site, as a museum. We're not, of course, still breaking.
That is true. Bletchley Park is not, despite the conspiracy theories out there, we do not do intelligence activities other than interpreting historical intelligence activities here on site at Bletchley Park. But you're right, music is still in the air here, isn't it?
It is. Through our public programmes, our 1940s weekends, we have musical bands here. We have music recitals and concerts. Our Christmas programme, which I mentioned earlier, we were inviting local choirs to come and perform. And that actually instigated our own staff and volunteers saying, well, should we not have a Bletchley Park choir? Mm-hmm. And we were saying, absolutely. If anyone's interested, we can give you a slot, some space to rehearse. And it makes me wonder if that's how things used to happen here during the war. People who were musical or interested or wanted to be involved were saying, we'd love it if we could have a gramophone concert. And people with encouragement being able to do that. So yes, applied differently, but music is still very much here at Bletchley Park.
It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.